You're probably at least somewhat familiar with the subjects of most of our Please Explain segments, but during today's discussion, you may find yourself saying, I didn't know that, every few minutes. Joining us now are Dr. M. Stanley Whittingham, professor in the Department of Chemistry and Material Science and Engineering and director of the Institute for Materials Research at the State University of New York, Binghamton, and Jeremy P. Myers, assistant professor of Mechanical Engineering, Material Science and Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Myers, let's begin with the most basic question. What is a battery?
Well, the way that I would describe it is a way of converting, storing chemical energy and converting it into electrical energy directly. When we think about other energy sources, we think about things like engines and so forth that are relying on combustion or somehow a release of thermal energy. And then a battery, we're taking that chemical energy that's stored in two different materials and tricking the electrons to leave one material and move into the other. And we can harness that current and use it for practical purposes.
And Dr. Whittingham, is the basic mechanism always a chemical reaction? And are the chemicals generally the same ones?
If you're talking about a battery, it's always the same mechanism. It's a chemical reaction, but the chemicals can be quite different.
So what's happening is we're tricking the chemicals to release their energy, and create electricity. I'm not sure I understand how that works.
Basically, we're trying to get the reactions to take place, releasing an electron, which then does work, and the chemistry takes place at the electrodes. And the trick is to stop them reacting directly without releasing that electron.
Dr. Myers, you wanted to add to that?
Oh, I don't think I could have said it much better.
Okay.
We're basically breaking the overall reaction of those two materials into two half reactions, and we're allowing each of those half reactions to occur where they're separated with whatever device we want to power. And so the flow of those electrons that are released in one place and consumed in another place allow us to get useful electrical work out.
How long have people known about this? I've read that there may have been a type of battery, the Baghdad battery, that was used in ancient times.
My understanding is that the Baghdad battery has been discovered by archaeologists, and I'm not certain if anyone had really demonstrated whether it actually worked or not. But the idea was that some of the same principles that we use now to use electricity might have been used for handling metal plating and so forth in some pretty primitive applications there. So that goes back a very long time, but I think most of the practical explorations of batteries went to the time where people started really discovering and making experiments on electricity.
Well, Dr. Whittingham, what led to the early development of the kinds of batteries we use today? Is it true that a frog was involved?
I think so, yes. I think Galvani back in over two centuries ago found out if he stuck two pieces of metal, different metals together, you could get a voltage out, and you put this across a muscle, it caused the muscle to react. So the frog leg would jump. And about, I think, 200 years ago, Volta built on that and put a whole set of zinc and iron pieces of metal together, put cardboard in between them, and built the first, probably the first real battery.
Dr. Myers, go ahead.
And it built on from there over the last two centuries.
So Alessandro Volta gave us the word volt.
Not exactly.
Hmm.
He was a pioneer in this area, and about 1880, the international community gave the really electric potential, gave his name to that in his honor.
Dr. Myers, can a frog body or a human body be thought of as a battery of sorts, or is that going too far?
Well, Well, what we can say is that the fluids of the body and some of the components there act as part of that separator, as it were, between the two disparate types of metals or two different types of materials that want to react. So we do have electrochemical processes occurring within the human body, but I think the demonstration that was done back in Galvani's time was more that electrical current, or rather ionic current, could be conducted through biological organisms.
Dr. Whittingham, I didn't realize until I did a bit of reading to prepare for this Please Explain segment that it was Benjamin Franklin who came up with the term battery and making a comparison with a battery of cannons. Can you describe the early battery that he was naming? How did it work?
Yeah, I think the term battery really means the addition of several electrochemical cells together. And what he did was built what we now call capacitors. So he would charge up glass bottles full of liquid, which had a metal films on the inside and the outside. Very much as you get electrostatic charge in the wind or if you brush your hair. So he built up charging inside and outside and put a whole lot of these in connection so he could build up a high voltage.
And why glass? And what kinds of liquids was he using?
He was just using, I think, weak salt solutions, and there's no particular reason to use glass. I suspect they were just available and held water nicely.
Mm. Dr. Maritz, aren't most of the batteries we see as consumers today called dry cell batteries?
That's the term that's often used there, and really what the reason that we have that is that for portable devices, we don't like things sloshing around. Generally speaking, any battery that we talk about is going to have two electrodes, two different types of electrodes through which the electrons can flow, and then some type of electrolyte, which does not conduct electrons, which essentially blocks those from direct contact with one another, but allows ions to move through and maintain electrical neutrality. So when we talk about a dry battery, what we're saying is that rather than having loose liquids sloshing around inside there, we have what is in essence a dryish paste that still has some moisture in it but isn't likely to spill or leak out.
Dr. Whittingham, the different kinds of storage needs determine the battery type used, don't they? For example, aren't sodium sulfur batteries used to store wind power?
The type of battery you use will be determined by the demand you have and the particular application, because they cost very different amounts. You can have very low cost rechargeable batteries, very expensive ones, and sodium sulfur is used for some very specialized applications because it is expensive, and I believe there's one on Long Island used to compress natural gas at night to put in the buses in the daytime because it then use lower cost electricity. But sodium sulfur was invented maybe 40 years ago and came commercial just 2 years ago.
Mm. You say it's more expensive, but it works in large projects.
Large projects, it operates at high temperatures, 300 degrees centigrade, so it's never going to go in your car or in your garage. But and so it needs professionals really to look after it.
My guests are Dr. M. Stanley Whittingham, professor in the Department of Chemistry and Materials Science and Engineering and director of the Institute for Materials Research at the State University of New York, Binghamton, and Dr. Jeremy P. Myers, assistant professor of mechanical engineering, materials science, and engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about batteries on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Myers, Dr. Whittingham talked about cars. He said we would never use sodium sulfur batteries in cars. What kinds are used in the battery-powered cars?
Well, we've seen for a while some of the early electric vehicles. We're still looking at the standard lead-acid battery, which is what we use to start the cars now. More recently, we've seen nickel metal hydride, where we have a nickel electrode on one side and we insert hydrogen into metal hydrides on the other side, and that has been developed and used in some of the hybrid vehicles. I think the the battery technology that's getting a lot of interest for the next generation of hybrid vehicles and for both plug-in hybrid and full-on battery electric vehicles is the lithium battery, which is based upon the same types of chemistry that we have in our cell phone batteries and laptop batteries today.
Why haven't we been able to develop a battery that can compete with petroleum in powering cars to go fast and over long distances?
Well, part of the reason for that is that the combustion engine, we really only want to run one way. We have fuel that gets burned, and the other point of that is that we're only carrying around half of the reactants there. That is, fuel by itself doesn't give us any power, but it's fuel combined with air that provides the combustion. In a battery system, if we're going to make things capable of storing energy and not only getting energy out but putting energy back in, we need both pieces there. And the simple fact is that electrochemical systems tend to happen a little bit more gradually and in a more controlled way than the combustion process.
By the way, and please explain, we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or on our Facebook page. Lots of different ways to reach us. Dr. Whittingham, what's the main difference between primary batteries, the ones that can't be recharged, and secondary rechargeable batteries of the sort that we will be using in cars if we ever wind up developing a decent electric car?
The primary cells, you can only discharge them, which means they're much simpler to manufacture, therefore they're much lower cost. So any rechargeable battery has to have a different chemistry where you can reverse the chemistry readily and do it hundreds of times, which means the construction of the battery is much more complicated. It uses more expensive materials.
Is recharging possible indefinitely?
Never indefinitely, I think. You slowly degrade the material over time, just like your car rusts, so do some of the components inside the battery rust over time and fall apart, so they'll never last forever. The goal is 10 years, and the primary cells, for example, in pacemakers last about 10 years now.
And you say that the rechargeable ones, what we're doing is we're reversing the process each time we recharge them?
Right, we're reversing all the chemical reactions each time we do it, so it's a fairly complicated process inside.
Well, and the only reason that all batteries aren't rechargeable, because it sounds like that's a much more sensible approach, is because they're so much more expensive?
They're more expensive because your dry cell, which uses zinc and manganese oxide, you can't easily remake the zinc metal. And on the manganese oxide, where you've got hydrogen going in and out, that falls apart fairly quickly. So you have to have special manganese oxides if you want it in a rechargeable battery. And in fact, even in the lithium batteries today, and I should say a lot of your hybrid electric buses in New York City now have lithium batteries in them, you don't actually use pure lithium because, again, on recharge, you can't plate it out safely. The lithium is, in fact, stored as a chemical compound inside graphite.
Well, Dr. Myers, the New York Times ran a front-page story the other day about a huge cache of lithium that's been discovered in Afghanistan. Is this a major resource discovery the way an oil reserve would be?
I am still trying to dig through that myself. What I would say, though, is that in all of these cases, the lithium that we have, the reactants that we have there, are not the primary source of power to begin with. When we find an oil reserve, that is a primary source of power, that we combine that with oxygen in the air and we burn it and we immediately get power out. In order for us to get a useful power out of a battery, we have to have some primary source. We have to charge that battery either from a traditional electrical grid where we have a coal-fired power plant or a natural gas-fired power plant or solar or wind or something like that. So batteries should last for a considerable period of time, as Dr. Whittingham mentioned. It's not the same as being that actual source of power there. So it's certainly helpful, but we also also hope that these battery systems will have the recycling and the full life cycle analysis that's necessary to ensure that we're not throwing that all away when we're done with it.
But what is it about lithium or nickel, for that matter, that makes them preferred metals for batteries?
Well, as we described before, what we're doing when we have a battery is we're separating two materials that have a difference in terms of the affinity for electrons to exist in that material. A single electrode by itself doesn't do anything. We need two different types of electrodes. And so lithium happens to have a very low potential relative to some of the other materials we'd consider, and it also happens to be very lightweight. So in the applications where we're concerned about being able to make this portable, to make it lightweight so that we can carry it around in a car without overwhelming the car with the weight of the batteries itself, it's a very useful device. And so there's a handful of chemistries that we can consider where we have some common materials between both electrodes so that we can make them compatible with one another, but where we can still exploit a large potential difference and harness that energy for practical uses.
Dr. William, a lot of people have been writing in about the disposal problem because we've been told not to put batteries in any of the different kinds of ways that we get rid of trash in New York. How environmentally friendly are batteries relative to other energy sources?
I think if you look at batteries as a whole, they're no more problem than any other source, and certainly much less of a problem than gasoline, which is carcinogenic. But if you buy a lead acid battery now from your store, they'll charge you more if you don't take your old one in. The other problem, a lot of the small rechargeables are the nickel cadmium batteries, and cadmium is very toxic. So people try to encourage those to be recycled. And certainly if you get into cars and buses and the like, they're all going to be recycled, and you're going to get a large amount of money back when you do recycle them. So I don't think it's a real issue. It's not going to be the same issue as we have, say, with TVs or computers when we throw them away. There will be value in these batteries, and people are going to recycle them.
Well, when I was a kid, I was told not to touch batteries because if they leaked, the acid would burn my hands. And I wonder if they really do leak and whether they explode, because I was also told that.
I think if you read any battery today, they told you not to toss them in the fire. Because just like any energy source, the reaction will be speeded up by heat. And if it goes too fast, they will explode. And I think we've seen when reactions get out of control, a few computer batteries have gone up. But the small, cheap batteries you buy from your drugstore are not well sealed. And today, it's not acid anymore. It's mostly alkali. And you've got to be very careful that small children, for example, don't swallow them. Because then the reaction will take place because you'll short the battery out with your stomach acid. So there are hazards there, but if you take normal care, there's no real problems, I think.
Well, Dr. Myers, we talked about handing batteries in when we get new ones, but what do we do with the batteries? We have the AA, the AAA batteries. How do we get rid of them?
Oh, I'm not sure about what's available in New York City, but there are many battery shops, or the battery shop down the street from me where I buy new batteries and so forth, will take old batteries and dispose of those properly there. So
We're going to have to go back to the stores.
That's generally what I've found is the easiest and best way to take care of them there. That if you're replacing a primary battery, they generally have the means for receiving and disposing of them there. So if you've got to buy new ones, you can get rid of the old ones, generally speaking.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls. Also, I will be reading off some of your comments that you've sent to our show page at WNYC.org. Our number here, 212-433-9692. My guests are Jeremy P. Myers, an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and Dr. M. Stanley Whittingham at the State University of New York, Binghamton, SUNY Binghamton. We'll be back with more right after this. We'll be right back. Pianist Jason Moran pushes the boundaries of jazz, and Grammy winner Bobby McFerrin tests the limits of the human voice. You can watch them both perform live in the Green Space this Monday. For tickets, go to wnyc.org/greenspace. This is WNYC and wnyc.org. And we are back with our guests, Dr. M. Stanley Whittingham, professor in the Department of Chemistry and Materials Science and Engineering and director of the Institute for Materials Research at the State University of New York, Binghamton, and Jeremy P. Myers, assistant professor of Mechanical Engineering, Materials Science and Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, just curious about the various categories, AA or AAA. Are they measures of the electromotive force of a battery?
Generally speaking, those standardized sizes are not only basically a description of the physical size of the battery, but also the capacity. As long as we have the same battery chemistry that we're talking about here, then there's not going to be differences in the voltage that we measure there. What those are generally telling us is how long can we draw current and what's the maximum current that we can draw from these particular batteries.
Well, why would somebody put AAA batteries in one device and AA batteries in another?
I believe it's generally just for the size, that if you've got a larger device, you'll want to probably be able to run it for longer. So you'll go with probably about as large a battery as you can get away with because you can power the device for longer without having to replace the battery.
And the A's are those really big-looking things, and then there are even larger batteries than that. Let's take some calls. Our first caller is Clayton from West Babylon. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my question was about electric eels, and I'm thinking that they must store the energy, and I'm wondering how they do that in a, like a fleshy animal and such, that you have separations in between the different components, really.
Are electric eels batteries is basically the question here. Do either of you want to feel that? Do either of you know?
I don't know for certain, but I do believe that it's the same general concept here, that they have organs that are made up of electrolytes, and they have capabilities of basically restricting the ion flow of the system there and can build up a potential difference. So it's similar there, but my understanding is that it's only pretty short duration that they can do there, so not really necessarily helpful as a power source.
Let's take another call. Dave from Briarcliff. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks a lot. I had two quick questions. One was, I have a friend who stores all of his batteries in his refrigerator before he uses them, and I was curious if that is really helpful. And the second question was, I have a lot of battery-operated power tools, and I'll use them for a few days, and then I might not get back to using them for like a month. And my question is, what do I do with the batteries when I'm not using them, because I seem to burn through batteries pretty quickly. I'm wondering, do I leave them in the charger or in the drill to discharge? They don't seem to last very long. So those are the questions. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for calling. Dr. Myers?
The storing the batteries in the refrigerator, I think, is not necessarily absolutely required, but not really a bad idea either, because as Dr. Whittingham mentioned, we have the process of rust that we can have the materials degrade there. And cooling these things down tends to suppress any of the side reactions or corrosion reactions that can degrade the quality of the battery. So I don't necessarily think it's absolutely required, but I don't think it's a bad idea either. In terms of how to handle rechargeable batteries in the charger there, it's going to depend upon the type of battery that you're talking about and about the type of the charger that one has. Generally speaking, with a lithium battery or something, you don't want to keep them all the way to their fully charged state, because some of the side reactions that can degrade the battery can be enhanced when you're near the upper range of that voltage there. So those you tend to want to keep somewhere in the middle range of charge there. But some of the charging devices there that people use can sense where one is in the state of charge and can help maintain the battery for longer life.
Dr. Whittingham, a listener writes in, sometimes when I need to replace batteries after a long time, there's a chalky substance near where the batteries touch the contacts. Is that a bad sign?
Yeah, it's suggesting you've got some corrosion going on, and you see this basically in the dry cells, the zinc manganese oxide ones. And if you're going to have a flashlight or some other device and not use it for a long time, the best thing is to keep the batteries out of it until you use it. It's the same reason you should replace the batteries in your fire detectors at least once a year, even if they're never used, because they will corrode there. And if you get corrosion on the contacts, and you see this in your batteries in your car as well, you get corrosion occurring at the contacts there.
I guess the big problem there is if you're reaching for a flashlight because there's an emergency, you don't want to go searching around for batteries as well.
Right. So put better batteries in there or rechargeable ones is my reaction. Don't buy the cheapest batteries you can find on the market. It is worthwhile getting the better quality ones.
Miriam from Manhattan asks, I read that Israeli scientists developed a potato battery. Could you explain how that works? And a number of listeners have wondered about non-chemical batteries, batteries that use organic sources.
Maybe I could respond to that. This is the same thing really what Volta did. If you get two different metals and stick them in something, the one I did as a kid, you get an orange and stick two metals in there, you get a voltage across it. Similarly in a potato or anything else that's got what we call an electrolyte in it, so it's a little bit wet inside.
So are potato batteries actually any more effective than orange batteries?
No, I don't think so. You can get a voltage across them. You can't really get any power out of them.
Okay, another listener we're going to now by phone. Philip from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have two questions, actually. One, the first one is this a technology that we feel is an old technology that we've pretty much, unless there's some sort of great advancement that we're not going to really see too many more, say, tremendous strides out of, or is this sort of a technology that maybe we're just starting to begin to scratch the surface on?
Well, we've been developing solar panels, haven't we? Those are batteries too, aren't they?
No, not really, because those are power sources, whereas these are sort of more akin to a computer's memory as opposed to its CPU.
Well, let's let our guests answer. It sounded to me, Dr. Whittingham, like you were about to say something.
Yes. I think you only need to look at how much money the U.S. Department of Energy has pumped into batteries this last year. There are still tremendous advances that can be made. We don't use what we can call all the chemistry energy today, and we certainly don't use it very efficiently.
Are solar panels batteries?
No, they're really generators of electricity, which then can get stored in a battery attached to the solar panel. But what people would really like to do, and I'm not sure it's possible, is to use lithium as one electrode, as we talked about earlier, and use air as the other electrode. So the air is free, you can store a large amount of energy, but there are huge challenges in making that rechargeable.
Dr. Myers, go ahead.
So I can say that there's lots of possibilities out there still. We're certainly not at the end of the road.
Dr. Myers, I've been reading about the negative aspects of using lithium. What makes it dangerous?
Well, I would say the description for a battery and the description for a hand grenade are pretty similar. You're trying to store as much energy as you possibly can in as small a space as possible, at least for any portable or automotive application there. And so that means that we have to do good jobs as scientists and engineers to ensure that energy doesn't get released in an uncontrolled fashion there. The only reason that I think we would consider lithium batteries to have any safety problem relative to the other types of batteries that we consider is that lithium delivers a higher voltage. So if there is some sort of a failure where the battery is punctured, where the two electrodes come into contact with one another, there is a larger driving force for energy to be released in that uncontrolled fashion there. But we have gotten much better at understanding that. As Dr. Whittingham mentioned, we generally don't use pure lithium in a lot of these systems now. We basically combine that lithium with other materials so that that we are limiting the rate at which the energy can be released, and that basically makes it safer there.
We go now to Larry from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, a question more about electricity than a battery itself, but when we talk about hybrid cars, people say, well, if you don't drive enough to generate enough electricity for your batteries in your car, at night you just plug it into some available socket. Nobody talks about how much that electricity costs, how much coal you use, how much what else you use. It's not a free ride and producing nothing obnoxious. What is the secret of using electricity for driving a machine? Who makes it? Who pays for it?
Well, generally speaking, the electric grid operates in such a way that we are able to meet every customer's demand every moment of the day. As it turns out, that means that we have to handle the peak power that happens when people turn on air conditioners or come home and power the lights and so forth. And so there's a real peak in demand in most places when people get home from work and so forth. And that's when electricity is sort of the least clean and the most expensive. And if we're charging our cars during the middle of the night when they're parked in people's garages, that's generally when electricity is cheapest for the utilities to produce, and also when things tend to be the most efficient. So there is, you're right, there's no such thing as a free lunch. That is, it still costs some primary source of energy to generate the electricity that's used to power these hybrid cars. But generally speaking, that can have lower emissions and lower cost than what happens if you have to go run that off of petroleum.
We thank you for your call. We go now to Tom from Greenwood Lake, New York. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I have a question. I know most cells are like 1.5 volts. Are all cells 1.5 volts? And or if not, what makes a cell a particular voltage?
Maybe I can respond to that one.
Sure.
It's the chemistry of the reaction. So when you talk about 1.5 volts, those are ones that basically have some water solutions in them, that they're your dry cells, and that's your alkaline cells you buy. If you look at your lead acid cell, that's 2 volts. If you look at lithium batteries, they're typically 3.5 to 4 volts, because lithium has a higher potential relative to its cathode. So it depends on the chemistry occurring within those batteries. The higher the voltage, the less cells you need to get a high-voltage system. So there are some advantages to going to a higher voltage.
A listener wrote in, what's the difference between a fuel cell and a battery, and what is a microbial fuel cell?
Well, a fuel cell is similar to a battery in that it is an electrochemical device where we're directly converting chemical energy to electrical energy. With a battery, though, we're generally talking about a system where we have all of that chemical energy stored within the device itself. A fuel cell is, in essence, sort of a cross between a battery and an engine, where we have a fuel tank and an air intake, and we are using the device as the little reactor chamber where we extract the electrical energy from the chemical fuels, from the fuel and from the air. A microbial fuel cell is a technology that has been under development for a while that generally produces very small amounts of power. We're generally talking, you know, milliwatts and in that range, but which is completely compatible with biological systems, so that we could actually implant these types of fuel cells inside a live subject and extract electricity to power some type of device that's inside the sample there, inside the specimen, from the nutrients and from the dissolved oxygen inside the body.
We are pretty much running out of time, but I wonder about developments that are occurring now that we might not know about. Do you see areas of research that are really promising? And I throw this out to both of you. Begin with Dr. Whittingham.
I think, as I said, we're getting new battery systems. We're talking about metal air systems, lithium, magnesium, which potentially can give you much more energy storage. But what I see as exciting is, you know, lithium batteries and like going into buses, these, in fact, because they're now totally electric driven, the small diesel engine is connected to a generator that keeps the bus going and charges the batteries, which partly answers previous questioners. So they're cleaner. When the buses are stopped, there's no pollution at all. They run totally off the battery. And as it's been explained to me by BA Systems here at Binghamton, the one big advantage of batteries and electric motors is they have much more power to start with, so a bus can get up to normal traffic speed, so merge into traffic much easier. So I think you're going to see them in buses, and I'd be very surprised if all vehicles aren't hybrid electric within the next 5 to 10 years, all new vehicles, because it saves a lot of gasoline, they're cleaner, and it'll save you money in the long run.
Well, we've kind of run out of time, so I'm not going to ask you, Dr. Myers, but Jeremy Myers is Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering, Material Science, and Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, and Dr. M. Stanley Whittingham is Professor in the Department of Chemistry and Material Science and Engineering and Director of the Institute for Materials Research at the State University of New York, Binghamton. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, we continue our 5-part series on HIV/AIDS by examining how the ethical issues surrounding the virus have and have not changed over the decades, from the ban on gay men donating blood to who should pay for life-saving treatments. Then Sebastian Younger on the documentary Restrepo, which chronicles the deployment of American soldiers to the most dangerous outpost in Afghanistan. Also, the director of Gasland about the hazards of natural gas drilling. And we'll take a look at the high rate of maternal illness and death around the world, especially in Africa and South Asia. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Matt Gurry, Matt Joseloff, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. We'll see you back here next week.